Hello.
Welcome to Converging Dialogues. This is Xavier Bonilla. On this episode, I'm very happy to bring the conversation I had with S. Frederick Starr. Fred is the founding chairman of the Central Asia Caucasus Institute and Silk Road Studies Program, which is a joint transatlantic research and policy center affiliated with the American Foreign Policy Institute in Washington and the Institute for Security and Developmental Policy in Stockholm. He is also a distinguished fellow for Eurasia at AFPC. He has his bachelor's in Yale, and he also has a PhD in history from Princeton, and 5 honorary degrees. He was the founding chairman of the Kennan Institute in Washington. He served as vice president of Tulane University and president of Oberlin College between 83 and 94. And he was very closely involved in planning the University of Central Asia and the Azerbaijan Diplomatic Academy. And he is also a trustee of one of the universities in Kazakhstan. He has written many books, including the widely acclaimed Lost Enlightenment, Central Asia's Golden Age from the Arab Conquest to Tamerlan. And he is also the author of the latest book, The Genius of Their Age, Ibn Sina, Biruni, and the Lost Enlightenment. And that is what we talk about in this conversation. We start off the conversation by talking about who these two men were, Ibn Sina and Biruni. We talk about their time, their context, what their world looked like. Much of it takes place in the steppe and some of the Silk Roads. A lot of it's in modern day Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan. So we try to give a historical kind of map of where things were and where it looks like today. We talk about the correspondence between these two and what that looked like. We talk about their interactions in the Muslim world, Ibn Sina's vizier, the canon of Ibn Sina, and the canon of Biruni. We talk about their work post-canon, how their works were preserved, the legacy of both of these thinkers, and many more topics. For me, obviously, Fred is tremendous. He's done incredible work in trying to understand generally, but really for a Western audience or English-speaking audience to really understand the history of the Caucasus region, Central Asia, the steppe, you know, and really how we're getting a lot of this access, and we're able to understand a little bit better the history, you know, post USSR, and really just opening the world literally to another side of the world, the West, if you will, of how these countries and these regions are super important and why their history is important globally. And he's been doing this work for a very long time. His book is absolutely fantastic. The one I mentioned previously, Lost Enlightenment, and the current one. So I highly, highly recommend both of those. As always, you can find this conversation and all other conversations at convergingdialogues@substack.com, also on YouTube. So get over there, like, subscribe, follow, tell your friends, support Fred's work. He's a wonderful, wonderful man, super brilliant. So make sure you get his books. And now I bring you S. Frederick Starr. I am here with S. Frederick Starr. Fred, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
Yeah, for sure. You've written a really wonderful book, wonderful, wonderful book that I'm very excited to talk with you all about. That book is called The Genius of Their Age, Ibn Sina and Biruni, and The Lost Enlightenment, about two figures that may be unfamiliar to some people, and hopefully people that read your book will not be able to say that anymore. And hopefully they'll get a little taste of it after our conversation. So I'm really excited about that. Just before we get into it, just tell listeners just a snapshot of who you are professionally, academically, and what you're currently up to.
Well, my formal function is I'm chairman of the Central Asia Caucasus Institute at the American Foreign Policy Council on Capitol Hill in Washington, and we have a parallel branch in Stockholm. And I am writing these days about Central Asia and a region that we tend to ignore. And but my background is I started in archaeology and working in Turkey, then spent many years doing Soviet studies, helped found the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center. But after the collapse of the USSR, I realized that we needed to learn about these new areas that emerged as independent states. Therefore, I shifted my focus to Central Asia and the Caucasus.
No, that's great. I think it's very, very important to be able to tell bits of history that are pretty consequential, but are in ways that many people in the so-called West over here don't know about and see the impact and the influence. So I think it's just tremendous. So you have two figures, these two giants in the book, going to be pretty unknown to a lot of folks, although there are some listeners around the world that they'll be like, hey, I know these two people already. So that will be nice for folks that do know them. But for those that don't, tell us who these two giants are, why they've kind of been unknowns to the world, and what is it that makes both of them so tremendous?
Well, giants is the right term. These were certified geniuses on a world level, past and present. Biruni was a, they were both polymaths, I should say. They were both, they were interested in everything, and they felt that it was their duty to plunge into every field and define it. So Biruni was, his forte was mathematics. He was keen on astronomy in all its dimensions. In mathematics, he was all over the map. He invented and developed whole new areas of mathematics, but he was equally interested in geography. And of course, interestingly, he used his tools of mathematics to explore geography. And in his case, he measured the Earth. He measured it more accurately, its diameter, than anyone down to the 17th century, using simple tools that he himself made. So that's Biruni. And he was also, by the way, a pioneer in anthropology and cultural studies. And he was a polymath. That's the right term. The other polymath was Ibn Sina. Now, he happens to be much better known for two reasons. First is he wrote a huge five volume. I mean, it's a big block. In modern editions, it covers a big shelf on medicine. And he did this 1,000 years ago, and he covered every area of medicine that he could conceive of. And that five volumes became the standard book of medicine throughout the world, from Europe through to India, for 600 years. So that made him far better known than Biruni. On the other hand, he also wrote a lot in science and also theology and metaphysics. And St. Thomas Aquinas read him with great interest, cited him, respected him. So these were both very big fish by any world measure. I wrote about them not just because they were two giants, but because they were exact contemporaries, knew each other, and absolutely despised each other. And it seemed to me, this is interesting. How did this happen? And how did each of them arise? Where did they come from? And why the conflict? Why the tension? And that is the subject of the book.
Yeah, no, that's great. Yeah, you have these two big polymaths, these brilliant thinkers. And if they're contemporaries, and why would it be that there's some negative interaction at least? So we'll talk about that. I guess the one thing that might be important for listeners is context. So kind of tell us the time in which they're operating, which century, and then kind of the setting. So you can use, you know, kind of the empires of the time, but then where that is. I believe it's modern day Uzbekistan. There's a lot of Central Eurasian former steppe area, which again might not be as familiar to some listeners. So just kind of parachute us into the kind of geography of the space they were inhabiting and the time frame they were.
Well, first of all, time, 1,000 years ago. That's very simple. Around the turn of the 10th to the 11th century. And it was known that they lived roughly at the same time, but an obscure German scholar was who figured out that they actually were really contemporaries. Now, geography is important. I think most of us have a sort of historical cultural map of the world that includes the ancient Middle East, that includes classical Mediterranean of Greece and Rome, that includes the Middle East of the Muslim era, but doesn't include Central Asia.
Yeah,
and these two figures were, although they had intimate connections with all those other regions I just mentioned, they were men of Central Asia. They were both born geographically in what is now Uzbekistan, but they spent together some time in Central Asia in what is now Turkmenistan up near the Caspian Sea. And then life fell apart. The place where they were living, in the middle of nowhere today, but then a great, great trading metropolis, was attacked by a very sinister figure, Mahmud of Ghazni. Ghazni's in Afghanistan. Well, he did utterly obliterated the place. Ibn Sina fled. He ended up spending most of the rest of his life in what is now Iran. And Biruni was captured by this Mahmud of Ghazni and hauled him off to Afghanistan, where he spent the rest of some 30-some years, the rest of his life. So that's the geography: Afghanistan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Iran. It's not the Middle East. It's not the Mediterranean. It's Central Asia.
Yeah, that's very important to note. I feel some people kind of forget that some of these Central Eurasian countries are there, and they have a deep, rich history, even before, you know, it was part of the Soviet Union and all of that. So let me say this right, is it Khwarezm? Is this kind of region?
Ah, now this is to me particularly fascinating. Khwarezm or Khwarazm is it?
Okay.
Properly, is today western part of Uzbekistan, the northeastern part of Turkmenistan. It is that we know it because of the Aral Sea, that sea that's drying up. There is one great river of Central Asia, the Amudarya, which was the Greeks called the Oxus, and it went from what is now Afghanistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, went through the whole region and ended up in the Aral Sea. And the Aral Sea was connected to the Caspian. Now, what that meant was that the pointed connection between the Aral Sea, the Oxus River, the Aral Sea, and the Caspian became a hugely important trading region. And it's called Khwarezm, and this is where Biruni was from, and the two of them then, for curious reasons, ended up spending 7 years in the same city in Khwarezm. So this is why do I dwell on Khwarezm? This was a huge entrepot. This is where east, west, north, south met. Think of the Silk Road. that's silk being hauled from China. No, the Silk Road, above all, was a connection to India. And up in Khwarezm, western Uzbekistan today, you will find ancient remains with paintings on the walls that could have come from India. I mean, it's astonishing. So they were in that region. They were in touch with everybody. There were Christians, Muslims, Buddhists, you name it. They were all there together. And it was very yeasty environment because of the trade.
Yeah, it's so fascinating how, again, you know, I didn't learn about any of this when I was in even in undergrad taking my world civilization class. It's so interesting how there's these pockets of places around the world that were so tremendous, so influential, different ethnic groups, different civilizations in some way. And again, trade seems to be like the very important thing here. So I want to ask about these two individuals, their upbringing. And how it was a little bit different. So you say for Barini, he was an orphan. Messina was born into wealth, and they're both trained and brought up with some education. They studied Aristotle. But just talk about their training and how they eventually get to medicine, they get to mathematics. What was their training like, and how their upbringing was maybe a little different at first?
Well, these were both sons of privilege, no question about it. As you correctly pointed out, Ibn Sina, his father was a very successful civil servant who had very independent religious ideas, by the way. But he had enough money to raise his boys to expose them to everything. He taught, made sure they knew languages. He made sure they knew law, medicine, you name it. He was extremely intense father in that sense. So Ibn Sina, you can say he was spoiled. He benefited from absolutely, in Bukhara. He lived in Bukhara, now in Uzbekistan. That's where he was born. And you could say that he absorbed absolutely the best knowledge that was available in that great city. Now, Biruni is a little different. Yes, he was an orphan. We don't know his background, but somehow he got adopted by a we would call it sort of Grand Duke of the local dynasty. And this Grand Duke, if you can call him that, was a major scientist, mathematician, astronomy, and so on. He raised the kid and imparted to him all his knowledge and put him in touch with everyone. So you have to say these were two very fortunate people. Why were they fortunate? Because they lived in a place at a time where there was money, definitely. But the money was connected to culture. It's connected to science, to learning in every dimension, theology, philosophy, metaphysics, you name it. And the two guys who raised them, his father and the Grand Duke, if you will, they aspired for their charges to be absolutely at the top in terms of what they knew.
Yeah, so it sounds like they really were getting a lot of things poured into them from an early age, right?
That's right. Poured into them is a good way to put it.
You're getting money, you're getting access, you're getting a lot of, you know, encouragement, all of these things. And obviously, you know, training, education is good, but it's, you know, you also have to kind of have the intellect and, you know, the kind of mental understanding of being able to kind of push for these things. So, but certainly I think, you know, in reading the book, it was like, yeah, these two had it okay, in the beginning.
They had it okay, but yeah. You know, you really have to give the folks who raised them credit, because they lived in wealthy times, in wealthy places, and yet they focused on hardcore studies. And this is something, you know, over 1,000 years, you look at that and say, wow, that's impressive.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where at the time, if I think about the 10th or 11th century and what was going on, in many parts of the world, they really had a drive and dedication for many of these things that, you know, it's insane how, you know, you're talking about that kind of, you know, that big block of, you know, like an encyclopedia, if you will, on medicine and how that was used for so many years, which is incredible to think about.
You mentioned drive.
Yeah.
This is something, I mean, that it seems to me it's a key word. Mm. Obviously, both of them were raised in such a way that all their ambition was poured into what we would call learning, science, yeah, humanities, et cetera. That's fine. But there was something special in both of them with regard to drive. And that is, by the time they were in their early 20s, they heard of each other. Mm. They were living a few hundred miles away from each other. And each caught wind that there's this super bright guy in Khwarezm or in Bukhara. And being young bucks, they were jealous.
Mm-hmm.
And so out of the blue, Biruni writes a perfectly pleasant but very detailed letter to Ibn Sina.
Mm.
How he delivered the letter is interesting. I wondered if he might have done it by carrier pigeon, but it was delivered. And there followed a correspondence between these two guys,
mm-hmm,
a couple of hundred miles apart, competitors who had never met and who were absolutely of the same age. And you read this today, it survives.
Amazing.
Mm. It survives. You read, or at least put it more precisely, Ibn Sina's version of it survives. Biruni's papers didn't come down to us, but you read this stuff today and you realize that the first letter from Biruni to Ibn Sina was very tough. But Ibn Sina's first response was very tough and polite. But from that moment on, the exchange degenerated. And pretty soon, they're each abusing the other, accusing the other of idiocy, of irrationality, and so on. And even though they continued to debate major, major issues in science and philosophy, you can just feel the seething anger and competition between these two young guys.
Mm.
That, in a sense, set the tone for their lives.
Yeah, it's very interesting how you see this in, I'm thinking of a pretty silly analogy here, but you see this when in sometimes in sports, right? Where, you know, many people will say, you know, oh, how did you get so great? How are you able to do this? You could take any sport you want, I guess. And somebody, usually it's a, well, there was the guy next to me or the guy coming up right behind me that was kept pushing me to be even better and to try and, you know, if I was just by myself, maybe I just kind of, you know, maybe tinker around with this, or maybe I'd be okay. But and it seems like this is the case here in this exchange with them. You talk about this correspondence in the book, and I guess the question is, what were they, aside from the kind of, you know, the personal kinds of slights, I guess, what were they mostly discussing in this correspondence? You mentioned that they were talking a lot about Aristotle. There's a lot of thinking about stars and planets and galaxies, using logic, using observation. Tell us the kind of the content and the tenor of what they were kind of arguing about in their correspondence at the time.
You were right to mention Aristotle for good reason. Why? Well, Aristotle was a genius of geniuses.
Yeah.
And he aspired to bring all knowledge under a single system. And he succeeded more fully at that than anyone in the ancient world. So the Aristotle had just recently, within the last few generations, been translated into Arabic. Who did the translation? Obviously, Arabs, mainly Syrian Christians.
Mm.
They were fortunate to know both the classical language and classical Greek and Arabic. They knew the Greek because of the Christian content of the Bible, but they also knew Arabic because that was their native language. So they translated, as did some Muslims working in Baghdad and elsewhere, translated Aristotle into Arabic. And this hit a few generations before Ibn Sina and Biruni, but it hit like a bomb. Everyone had to reckon with this. Okay, what's the meaning of all this for us?
Yeah.
And in this period, by the way, Aristotle was not forgotten, but he certainly receded far into the background in Europe. So here are these two young guys, off in the middle of nowhere, reading Aristotle with absolute, you know, beady eyes, and then arguing over what does he mean, and is he always right? Or did he leave some windows still open? And this was what they fought over. Generally, Ibn Sina was the pro-Aristotle guy, and Biruni was the questioner. But they both agreed that you can't paint around Aristotle. And this provided the perfect setting for them to define themselves with respect to the other.
It's interesting how this figure from so long ago in ancient Greece is somebody that's still pushing and pulling with people's different ideas, which is fascinating.
I can interrupt us briefly. What I got from the study of these two and their contemporaries, I wrote about in an earlier book called Lost Enlightenment about the golden age of Central Asia. What you get is a profound respect for what ancient Greek learning achieved. My gosh, they were formidable. And you could define the fate of learning up until the Renaissance as to, in terms of the fate of the classical Greek writers. Who was known, who wasn't known, who was translated, who wasn't translated. And these two guys, Biruni and Ibn Sina, inconceivable that they would have achieved their greatness without a big nudge from classical Greece.
Let me ask a question on this. There's sometimes people in a more modern context will say, well, we don't hear enough about contributions from other people in other parts of the world at different times. We only hear about the Greeks and maybe the Romans, and then we get to the Renaissance or we get to the Enlightenment. And what about folks from, Arabia or folks from Iran or folks from, different parts of the world? And I mean, we'll obviously talk about these two guys, their contributions on their own right. But it does seem that at many points, maybe not for everybody, but at many points, a lot of these people in the 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th century were interacting with the Greeks. I mean, it's not like it's a one or the other kind of the thing. It is important to see the kind of holistic view of people were interacting with different ideas throughout time, wherever they came from. I mean, what do you think about this?
I think that's, you really hit an absolutely major theme, and that is how ideas survive, travel, interact, and in both of cases of Ibn Sina and Biruni, we can absolutely directly name the source, and that is trade. Trade carried not just goods, but ideas. And these ideas, again, the whole concept of the Silk Road suggests a sort of passive region through which Chinese were carting silk to Europe. Wasn't that way at all. It was definitely two ways, A, and B, its first, as I mentioned earlier, its first goal was on the east was India, most steadily. So you have, and from the west, you have the entire Mediterranean world, the Christian world, the Greek world, the Roman world.
Yeah.
And we're talking about the region, Central Asia, the only region where they totally interact. And so these two young, very bright, very well-educated men grew up with this very heady atmosphere of the best thinking from everywhere. Give an example. Up until this time, if you wanted to count. There was strange systems of doing so. It was the Indians who invented what we call incorrectly Arabic numbers and the decimal system and all that. Indians invented it. How did it get to the West? Through Central Asia. Mm. Central Asians trading with the Indians say, "Hey, I like the way you do your accounting." You know, and they borrowed it. And then they wrote about it. Mm. One of the people from Khwarazm, again, named Al-Khwarizmi, meaning the guy from Khwarazm, he really led the introduction of what we call incorrectly Arabic numerals into the Mediterranean world. Mm. And so this is typical. This is why they could only have come from this region. No other place on earth was directly connected to the Middle East, to the Mediterranean, to Europe, mm. to China, to India. It's unique.
Mm. Mm. Yes, it's. I mean, there are certain places at just certain points where there appear to be this kind of crossroads, this kind of intersecting of, like you're saying, ideas, trade, you know, people groups, things like that. You know, I mean, and this is one place. I mean, maybe other people might know of. You know, Istanbul has kind of been that way at different points as well. It is this kind of
intersecting. Not the intensity of connection to the East. This is absolutely unique in the both India and China, two great Eastern civilizations, both of them are alive and represented in Central Asia, as are the Europeans, Mediterraneans, Arab world, etc.
Yeah, it's right there at that doorstep, right? Of like, you know, it's right there. People are coming, people are going. I think it's important, the point you make about not only were people coming from the East, but then they were going backwards as well, or going the other way as well. So there's this kind of two-way kind of piece there. There's an interesting piece here that you talk about. So obviously they have their correspondence, but you talk about the encyclopedia, Biruni's treatment of the ideas of Arabs and Muslims for the ideas of astronomy and science, and looking at history and juxtapose, I guess, with Herodotus. Talk about that element of what he was looking at to Arabs and then Muslims generally at that time. What was he pulling from there? What was he trying to interact with these kind of ideas?
Well, thanks to all this translation of the ancient Greek writers, many of whom lived in Roman times, by the way, so they were, you could call it Greco-Roman culture. Thanks to all this translation into Arabic, which was like Latin in the West. Didn't mean that if you spoke it, you were an Arab. It was just the language of education. But due to all this, the idea of mastering this forgotten heritage from the classical world, this was where it was at. They were immersed, if you will, in classical studies. But they didn't just read them, they did so very critically and wanted to add on to that. Mm. And I think that is one of the stimulating forces in all this. And that is that, especially for young people, the time these two geniuses were growing up, here is this massive block of learning in every field from the ancient, from the classical world. They wanted, hey, we want to be on top of this, but we want to add to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the shift from simply absorbing to adding to or perfecting that occurred in Central Asia and which these two geniuses epitomized. And imagine, on the one hand, Biruni measuring the using. If you recall your high school and college math, using sign laws with very complex mathematics to measure the distance from the Earth to the Moon or to the Sun. Well, he developed his own sign tables. Mm. These came from India, by the way, not from ancient Middle East.
Mm.
he worked all this stuff out. And he invented, for example, in another area, specific gravity. The idea of specific gravity was his, but he then developed tools, equipment that could measure specific gravity up to 3 or 4 decimal points. It's the level of intensity that these two guys achieved, which amazes me. Ibn Sina, similarly. I mean, okay, he's looking for a gig, if you will. He wants to decide how is he going to make his way in the world. And he could go in 5 fields, and he did. But he decided to really make his name in medicine. Sits down and writes these 5 enormous volumes.
Yeah.
This is a level of intensity that this environment created. It was unique, but these two people, each epitomized it, and that's why they're of importance today. But I'd add a further element. We think of all our friends who are researchers or scientists or techies, you know. They're all thinking, we have this grant, this organization I work with has this big foundation grant or government contract or Lord knows what, some corporation. Mm-hmm. They're fat and happy. By comparison, these two guys who started life so, you know, on a silver platter, if you will, these two guys couldn't imagine more difficult lives. They from their mid-30s on, both of them absolutely were under the gun. At one point or another, each of them was condemned to be beheaded.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine that? And they were always chasing patronage. They were always finding security because there were wars buzzing around them. And yet they did what they did. They kept their eye on the ball. This, it seems to me, as we look at our very spoiled scientists and people of learning today with all their grants and contracts and tenure and blah, 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 these guys had none of that. And yet look what they did.
I wonder if it's almost because of that, right? That this is the space where they can kind of, you know, move away from all of that, and they can say, okay, you know, here's where I can kind of get lost in this, and they can push for that and really dedicate their time. But certainly, I mean, it's a different time, and there's different things, and it's one of those things where it's like, yeah, you have wars and you have all these things going on around you. You have a tough place to live in some regards. You know, that's not going to make the best environment. No one's sitting in like some really, you know, quiet study and just, you know, contemplating, you know, maybe there were moments of that, but there's this space of like, you know, real hardship in a lot of ways. I mean, living in the 11th century wasn't probably easy in a lot of ways from what we are used to today. And there's this interesting point in the book where you talk about, I think it's in 1004, 1005 this year of, where for 7 years, they both lived in the same city, right? And Biruni's work as the vizier to the Shah of Khwarazm was important for his research. This is this interesting point here. Why? Tell me about these 7 years and how he was the vizier. And you can explain that to listeners what that is. But tell us about this kind of period. This is really interesting.
Well, as we discussed at the beginning, Biruni was from Khwarazm, now Western Uzbekistan. Well, the city he grew up in had disappeared because it was washed out by the Amudarya River, which flows into the Aral Sea, et cetera, et cetera. And therefore, the power center of the region shifted to a new city, which is called Konya Urgench today, and it's in the north of Turkmenistan. And a new dynasty grew up there, and Very briefly, it was only 20 years or so. Very briefly, this dynasty at Kunya Urgench in forgotten corner of Turkmenistan was arguably the intellectual center of the world, because the local ruler attracted talent. And he had the top people in every field in the sciences and learning. And of course, in that context, he went for Bidrumni, a local guy, and he brought in Ibn Sina from Bukhara, who was out of a job anyway. So here they were for 7 years together in this new burgeoning capital in the middle of what was then a very important region of the world. And we know they had common friends because both of them spoke of people who were friends with the other guy. There's not a speck of information that confirms that they ever interacted directly. They were not living, in the middle of some world megacity today where they could easily ignore each other. No, this was a new city of a few tens of thousands of people, which was very rich, but it had one court at the center. And these two guys both were there because of that court and were obviously interacting on a daily basis. They clearly, this defined each of them against the other. And then they went out and pursued their separate ways.
It's so interesting. Yeah, their dynamic together is really, really interesting. So okay, but tell me about the vizier piece of it, about and him being for the Shah of Khwarazm. What was that?
Here's a young guy who's competent at everything, and he is working as a sort of, not working, he is being a kind of prize horse in the stable of the local, of a new and very ambitious ruler. Well, that ambitious ruler dies and his son takes over. The son isn't as confident as the old man. And there is down in Afghanistan a new power rising under Mahmud of Ghazni. And Mahmud has a heck of an army. I mean, really big army. He has hundreds of war elephants. And that's, this is atomic threat. And because of mishandling of and because of Mahmud's sheer ambition, Mahmud not only conquered Samarkand, Bukhara, which is why Ibn Sina ended up going up to Khwarazm, but Mahmud attacked Khwarazm itself, and the ruler, insecure, very pleasant guy, very bright, very cultivated person, didn't know what to do. He turned to Biruni. He thought, "You know everything. You're good at everything. Why don't you be my prime minister?" Well, this produced no good results. Indeed, Mahmud conquered the place. He took the entire regime, put them out in the central square, and had them crushed by war elephants. And he took Biruni back to Afghanistan with him as a prize pack cow. This is a trophy of war, and set him up actually so that he could do his work in Afghanistan. But it was purely for his ego, for Mahmud's ego, that he kidnapped, basically, Biruni. But that was the end of Biruni's public life. He never again took any office. Ibn Sina, by contrast, he decided that, hey, that's a way to go. And he, for the rest of his life, as he was moving from one city to another, in what is now Turkmenistan and in Iran, as he moved from one city to the other, in every place they hired him to be a prime minister. And so all his philosophizing, all his science, all his medicine was done in what, if you will, in the night shift.
That's incredible. Wow. This goes back to the earlier point you were making about how, you know, these men didn't have easy lives, and you basically get taken hostage under this other ruler, and you're still, you know, burning the midnight oils over here, trying to, you know, still do work. He wrote this canon as well, Biruni, right? He wrote a big piece as well.
Too. But interesting, and this is we're at point zero here. Each of them writes a canon. This is a Greek term that found its way into Arabic. And in the case of Ibn Sina, his canon of medicine, five volumes,
right.
His goal was to get it all together in one place. His assumption was that, yes, that's possible. And he produced something which, on the one hand, is very accessible, very well written, very clear. And on the other hand, it's a closed system. He answered all the questions, if you will. Now, Biruni's canon is totally different in character. Mm. And by the way, there's still not a really good English edition of it, but that's another matter. Biruni's canon is basically work in progress. He deals on all sorts of issues, basic issues of science, mathematics, astronomy, et cetera, basic issues, so many of which are not resolved. And he ends up in his canon saying, well, okay, if you want to resolve this, what you need to do, and say it's in astronomy, you need to wait 231 years until this planet are in just the right position, and then you have to have a very good observatory, and so on. In every field, Biruni's writings had the smell of what we would call work in progress reports. Everything for Biruni was open-ended. You know, how I regret that I won't be around when this next cycle astronomically occurs and we could observe such and such. And he was this way with everything. Everything was, you have the feeling that Biruni viewed the world as a challenge for the future. Intellectually, how to answer the great questions. Hmm. Whereas Ibn Sina answered the great questions to his satisfaction and to the satisfaction of people everywhere for hundreds of years. So not only are they each in his own way very distinctive geniuses, but the contrast between them is one of the fundamental contrasts of human life. Mm-hmm. Those who look for closed systems that are all embracing and solid, and those who are comfortable with open ended questions, yet continue to live.
Mm. Yeah, the way Biruni did a kind of his more open system is very, very interesting. That makes a lot of sense. That sounds very, in some ways, analogous to how, you know, we do science now. It's like, well, you know, future directions, you know, conclusions are always hedged a bit, you know, whatever. I guess I'm interested, Ibn Sina, that's a wild, wild, like, this is completely ambitious. Like, you write these big volumes, but as you talk about in the book, he focused on, like, so many different things: anatomy, psychology, preventative medicine, health, all these therapeutic procedures, even pain relief. And that was the standard for medicine for hundreds of years. I mean, how can you say that and have it so somewhat authoritatively? Like, was he just like legitimately a genius? Like, was he really intelligent? Like, I mean, I don't even know half the stuff I know in my own field, right? There's no way I would write a big like volume of all these things to say definitively. How did he know all this? How did that happen?
But I think there is a very simple answer, one word answer, Aristotle.
Okay.
Each of them studied Aristotle very carefully, but drew fundamentally different conclusions. Diderot said he watched Aristotle's method, and he said there's something in this method that is worth pursuing. He respected Aristotle's conclusions, but was quick to use Aristotle's own methods and the methods of mathematics and other fields to go into uncharted territory. Ibn Sina, by contrast, looked at Aristotle's system, and he said, wow, he brought it all under one roof. And his goal was not just limited to medicine. I think medicine he did with his left hand. It was easy for him. He didn't consider it that serious. But he then went into every other field and wrote up what he considered the definitive answers. Each of them was being the new Aristotle, but each of them found a different Aristotle to emulate. One was process-oriented, the other was conclusion-oriented.
That's so fascinating to see it that way. I mean, the way you explain it makes a lot of sense. I guess the one piece I have here is you know, obviously they take Aristotle as the model, and then they do way more of sorts, and they have their specific contributions. I mean, I guess, you know, without getting into too much detail, I guess, but for people that listen, they say, okay, I've read Aristotle too. Yeah, I've read his stuff. Like, yeah, he's got some hits. Okay, Aristotle's cool. What did these guys contribute, right? Are they just like kind of, you know, regurgitating, or just kind of a, you know, whatever Aristotle, like, what is the like specific things for either one of these guys? Maybe just one or two examples of like, nobody had thought about this before these two men wrote this down. And how, yeah, build off of Aristotle's, you know, his model or his heuristic or whatever. But what did they contribute? Maybe Ibn Sina is a good example for medicine or something. But what did they specifically, where people for, you know, 500 years were like, yeah, this guy wrote down this 5-volume canon of medicine and we still use that. What were some specific examples of their specific contribution?
Well, let me start with Ibn Sina. He was interested far more than he was interested in medicine. He was interested in the primal causes of everything. And when he turned to Aristotle, his great concern were with, where does our universe come from? Yeah, how did it come to be? What was there before? Was there something before our universe? Are there other worlds parallel to ours but different? These are mega questions, and they absolutely engaged Ibn Sina. And this is why you have a formidable army, not army, unfortunately, but a formidable gang of really impressive scholars in America, in England, in Europe, in the Middle East, in Central Asia, in Russia, who are studying Ibn Sina's deep thoughts on these imponderables, on the existence of God, on the nature of God. What is the soul? Ibn Sina defined the soul as consciousness. And he went on at great length in his last huge comprehensive encyclopedic work. He went on at great length about whether animals have souls. And what is the evidence pro and con, and so on. This is typical of his approach. Now, Ibn Biruni, by contrast, he had a wonderful nose for the weakness of argument and argumentation, not only with Aristotle, but Ptolemy and other great ancient thinkers. And he, for example, was fascinated by locating on the globe. Of course, they knew exactly the world was round. That was not an issue. But locating exactly on the globe, all known points. Where is your city? Where is your city? What's the latitude? What's the longitude? Well, he built a globe and put pins on these globes, on this globe, for every place where he knew the latitude and longitude. Some of these had been collected in ancient times, hundreds of them.
Wow.
He put them on his globe. But then he sent people out, or he himself, when he's in a new place, like being in Ghazni in Afghanistan, added that, put a pin for that. Then this is typical Biruni. It's not what Ibn Sina would have done. Biruni then asks, well, now wait, the westernmost pin is over here near the Hebrides, let's say. The easternmost pin is out in the Sea of China. And that only comprises less than half of the globe. What's on the other half? Now, here he's back to Aristotle and back to the classic, of whom there are many, Ptolemy especially, these incredible Greek thinkers. I mean, you just have to be in awe of
them.
He said, well, they say that there was a world ocean out there on the other side. But then Biruni, using his logic, says, so now wait a minute. On the part we know from the Hebrides to the China Sea, there is land all the way there. And why, and that obviously fits rules of nature. Why should the rules of nature on the two-fifths of the world that we know about suddenly be suspended for the other three-fifths?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Therefore, he said, there must be land out there on the other side of the world.
Mm.
Then he asked, well, wait a minute, if there's land, a continent or two, could it be inhabited? Well, he says, well, looking again at his pins on his globe, which Mahmud was eventually destroyed, looking at his pins, he said, well, now the northernmost pin is way up there near, but it's now Finland, and there are people living up there. And the southernmost pin is down here in Africa or southern India. There are people living there. Therefore, unless these land masses on the other side of the world are shoved into the north and the south, which you'd have to explain, we have to assume that those land masses are the way they are in the known part of the world. Therefore, they are in an inhabited zone, inhabitable zone. Conclusion, therefore, this guy sitting in the middle of Afghanistan in 1000 AD concludes that there must be unknown continents out there and that they must be inhabited. Now, this is from a guy who never saw an ocean.
That's so incredible to me. Like the way you describe it, the way you lay it out, he's doing this in the late 10th century, early 11th century. Never seen an ocean. Blows my mind. That blows my mind.
They were, each of them, in his way, was, I mean, you just sit back in awe.
Yeah.
You know, I doubt if I think Ibn Sina was very social.
Mm.
He had a very active sex life. We know that.
Mm-hmm.
It's very well documented. He was hooping it up. He had a good time.
Mm-hmm.
Biruni was exactly the opposite. He was, I think, a rather dour personality. But each of them, from their point of commonality as young men to the end of their lives, and they both were to the end of their lives, each of them just never, they were relentless. They never let up.
Mm-hmm.
No retirement for these guys.
That's the other thing. And so you make these big, scholarly works, these big volumes of stuff. And then you get the next movie or the next album or the next book or the next, you know, there's no sophomore slump here. They just keep churning them out until their death, which is just incredible.
And the last words that we have from Ibn Sina, the last phase of his life, suggest that he was opening his mind to some very, very radically different ways of thinking than he had pursued for most of his career. And that was at the very end of his life, when he was, by the way, running around with the vizier's army. But this, he was still going in new directions.
Wow.
In the case of Biruni, it's amazing. We know that when he was dying, he was visited by an old friend of his, from what we now know as Helmand in southern Afghanistan, very sophisticated guy. And Biruni is on his deathbed. And this old friend visits him. And the old friend is an expert on some obscure area of law. And Biruni is barely alive. Starts quizzing him on the details of law. And his friend says, Biruni, hey, you're dying. What in the world are you quizzing me on these details of law? Biruni says, wouldn't it be better for me to die knowing the answer than not knowing the answer? So these were astonishing human beings, both of them.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, it's so fascinating to hear these kinds of stories from a very faraway place, at least from my vantage point, and then also, you know, how they were able to do all this is incredible. So one thing I was in the end of the book, you kind of talk about this. I was curious about this. Is so they die obviously, and I'm curious about how two points: how was their work passed down and preserved for centuries later? And people thought to do that, and how that kind of worked, I guess, briefly. And then, you know, who were their proteges, who followed up on their work afterwards in the, you know, century, you know, or the, you know, decades, years, decades right after, and then centuries later, people are, you know, picking them up. So yeah, how was their work preserved and passed down? And then how did other people kind of take up the mantle and say, well, you know, they got this right, but we're going to keep pushing this further. And then this, and this, and this, how did that kind of spell out for the first, you know, a couple hundred years after they died?
But let's recall that Biruni is sitting in Afghanistan, and Ibn Sina's last days were in what is now in Persia, and what is now Iran. Therefore, it was far more likely that copies of works by everything was copied, of course, not printed. Copies of works by Ibn Sina would travel into the Mediterranean world than it was for works of Biruni. And also because Mahmud of Ghazni, even though he had an extraordinarily rich and powerful state, was not a trading state. Therefore, there weren't the caravans of camels running in and out that you could throw some manuscripts on. So that gave Ibn Sina an initial advantage. Then they both suffered from the fact that when the Mongols came through, whole libraries were obliterated, burned, destroyed.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we know, for example, that at one library in what is now Turkmenistan and Merv, that the Mongols destroyed a collection that included piles of works by Biruni. And by the way, of the total of both of them, we don't have probably more than a fifth of what they wrote. So imagine what my book would have been about these two geniuses, and we had a four-fifths of what they were. Okay. Then, however, Ibn Sina's work, because he was so interested in issues of philosophy, and we would call it theology, attracted far more attention. I mean, the medicine, of course, brought his name everywhere. But these other concerns meant that there was a whole industry in the Muslim world and then in the Jewish and Christian worlds to pursue these great questions of metaphysics and philosophy and theology. So little by little, Ibn Sina entered the west and crossed the Mediterranean, if you will, and was translated into Latin, which this didn't happen with Gibbon. And it was only actually in the middle of the 19th century that a German scholar came across one of two of Gibbon's great books.
Wow.
He patiently wrote out versions in classical Arabic, corrected versions. Then he translated these versions into German. Then he translated them again into English. And this effort actually put Biruni back on the map. And ever since, he's been, his star has been ascending.
Wow, that's quite a feat to do. That's three languages.
You know, it's very interesting question. To what extent did Biruni's understandings of astronomy did they penetrate to Europe? And we're talking about Galileo, and we're talking about different. Copernicus and so on. This is a very involves very technical issues, but interestingly, a scholar, again, this all depends on reading scholar works by scholars in very obscure places that you suspect no one else is reading, but a European scholar went through Copernicus's work and discovered that some key ideas of his that created the Copernican universe, if you will, that is based around the sun, the key ideas of his had come from a 14th century Middle Eastern astronomer. And he, this scholar proved that he had actually, that Copernicus had used this book because his he included some engravings from the 14th century book in his own. And you could, the way his numbering system for these, he simply didn't change from the original. So this proved that Copernicus was reading this medieval Arabic scholar. Astronomer. That astronomer, actually was Persian by ethnicity, that scholar was in turn a direct and proud heir of Biruni. So this is, it's very, very finicky stuff. It's not stuff that you can just walk into. You have to dig out all these details. But what it shows is that Biruni's footprints were carried far beyond his name.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's the thing, right? That's true legacy, right?
Yeah, that's the real thing.
That's the real thing right there. So the last question I have for you is, you know, if really is about their legacy of both these men, but one of the things I'm curious about is, you know, if people, you know, get out there and they pick up your great book, what are, you know, kind of the main things, the one or two things or whatever it might be that you want, you know, people to walk away with to say, yeah, you got the essence of what I was trying to say. What is that kind of, what are those two, one or two big things that you want people to kind of walk away with?
Achievement in the face of grave challenges. The virtues of tenacity. You know, these guys just stuck with it. Aiming high. It starts with their education. You couldn't have started these guys. Biruni or Ibn Sina wouldn't have become what they became had their education began in college. You know, they were, from the earliest days, they were the beneficiaries of wonderful education. And finally, I think they both set an example of what individuals, great minds, are able to achieve in the worst of times. And instead of moaning about our fate, you know, oh gosh, this grant didn't come through or stuff like that, we should just get on with it, figure out how to do it. They did.
Yeah.
At the risk of their lives.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's absolutely right. I think, you know, one of the things that I try to tell folks sometimes is, yes, we can acknowledge our suffering and our ills and things in the world. And some people have it worse or better or whatever. It's all relative in some ways, but I think it's more of what you do with it, right? How do you say, okay, how do I, you know, kind of go through whatever I'm going through, and how you still persevere? You still have a drive to say, I want to, you know, do this, or, you know, that you're contributing. And I think just looking at the perils of the world's always going to be, you know, negative in some ways. But it's more of how are we, you know, shaping and moving things.
Let me give an example.
Yeah, please.
From each of their lives.
Yeah.
Both of them, as I've mentioned earlier, were seen by this sinister and extremely powerful figure from Afghanistan, Mahmud of Ghazni, as people he wanted in his court to show off. And at one point, though, Mahmud got wind that Bibini had some very, very unorthodox views. And Mahmud was very pious and straight down the center line. And so Bibini was condemned to be beheaded. And by some process that we don't know, he ended up being sent instead to a period of exile right across the border into Pakistan. And there, interestingly, he was locked up in a castle, which is still there, by the way. And it is there that he did all the research that led to the measuring of the diameter of the earth. With equipment that he himself built and with the mathematical tables that he himself developed. Okay, that's achievement in the face of the worst situation. Ibn Sina, the same. Mahmud hounded him. He missed him the first time when he successfully captured Bibini. He missed him. But over the years, he persisted on this. And at one point, he sent an army into Persia and attacked the city where Ibn Sina was working and where he was serving as a vizier, as a prime minister. They managed to seize Ibn Sina's library, piles of books, some of which presumably ended up back in Ghazni. By a hairbreadth, they missed capturing Ibn Sina himself. My point is, these guys were living on the edge, on the precipice, their whole lives. Once they left this nice, comfortable place in Western Uzbekistan or in Northern Turkmenistan, once they left there, where they'd been together for 7 years, both of their lives were continually under the gun. Yeah, look what they did.
Yeah. No, I mean that's it right there. And I think that's another part of all the things they wrote was great legacy there, but also the way they lived life was great as well. Fred, this was such a wonderful conversation. I was really, really enthused in reading your book and talking with you all about it. You have such a great way of explaining and really bringing them to life. So I'm super happy with the conversation. And I just can't say enough thanks for you for coming on and talking to me.
Thank you. It's great fun. And it's an honor for me to have found such a conscientious and open-minded reader.
Yeah, no, I mean, listen, I mean, this stuff's important. So big thanks.